This episode of The Candid Frame is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club. Their carefully curated selections reflects the best in contemporary photography and all for a reasonable price. And they are delivered directly to your doorstep each month. They offer free shipping to the US, Canada, and the UK. It's subsidized elsewhere. It's a great way to begin or expand your photo library. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com today. And remember to use the promo code THECANDIDFRAME at checkout. You shouldn't be surprised that some people who practice photography live with varying degrees of blindness. As unlikely as it might seem at first blush, there are countless examples of photographers whose eyesight falls short of 20/20, but who still manage to enjoy a creative life that involves making photographs. Chris Gambit is one of them. Many of you know him from his work as the founder of the Photographer website, a news blog dedicated to all things photography. Despite his visual challenges, he has succeeded in creating a unique presence in photography. Though I've known Chris virtually for a while, I wasn't aware of his issues with his vision until recently. And when I did, I reached out to him to learn more about his journey. I hope his story helps provide insight to the many people who don't allow a disability to deter them from practicing their passion. This is Ibarian X, and welcome back to The Candid Frame. It was great seeing you in New York. That was the first time I met you in person, too.
Yeah, it was so insane because I was like, yeah, I know this guy's voice, but like I haven't seen him in a while. And I was like, wait, he's here? So, yeah, no, it was wonderful to see you and like, you know, being in your presence and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's this whole thing, you probably know, it's so strange. You're familiar with someone for years, may even have talked to them, but you don't meet them in person until years later. And it's like, wait, we haven't met? Because it feels like we had.
Yeah, 100%, man. It's even crazier for me as well, too, because I'm legally blind. So, like, it takes me a while to be able to understand and see someone and detect their mannerisms and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and then it also depends on the lighting that I'm in and all that kind of stuff. So, believe it or not, I actually detect most people by sound first.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I read the essay I think you wrote last year when you were talking about your eyesight, and I hadn't realized when we had first talked that you had issues like that. I was like, well, he's a photographer. He must be able to see well enough. And then discover later that, you know, what you've been challenged with. It was really fascinating to see what you've been able to accomplish, not only in terms of the photographer, but just with your own photography and your own career within photography. It's even more inspiring to acknowledge the struggle that you were facing.
Yeah, thank you. It's, you know, I see the world like a painting, and people tell me it's a blessing and a curse, especially with what I have. I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, I try to make it more of a blessing than I can a curse, whatever I can.
When were you aware that there were issues with your eyesight? How young were you?
Well, I knew that it was really bad when I was like 13 or 14 in high school. And, you know, I had like an immigrant mom that was really old school. My parents are from Guyana, which has a lot going on in the world, especially with right now. And she wasn't very well educated. And I would tell her, I was like, Mom, I can't really see very well. And she was like, no, you're too young for this to be happening. Mm-hmm. And then it would happen when we were looking at the television. And I'm like, Mom, I can't read the text on the bottom of the news bar when we were watching like CNN or something like that. And she's like, no, you're too young for this to be happening. And then one year, my parents were divorced and my dad was telling my mom, he was like, you know, you should probably take the kids to the eye doctor because my insurance is running up and I don't really know what's going to happen. So she took us to the doctor and the doctor was like, no, your son's like blind and he has been for a while. And it took a doctor to to get her to believe that I was actually going blind. So because of that, in Catholic school, you would sit alphabetical order, and G is either all the way in the back or all the way in the front. And the classes that I sat all the way in the front for, I did better in. And the classes that I sat all the way in the back for, I didn't really do very well. I'd be sitting there like squinting. And when you're squinting at something, your vision gets even worse. And it continued to get worse. And then in young adulthood, like early 20s, I started to get these really terrible astigmatism headaches. And they really amplified when I entered the workforce. And by that, I mean, like, after my internships, I started my internships at PC Mag and Magnum Photos. You know, those were simple enough. But then I started working at B&H Photo. And that is a stressful place to work. And it made my vision go even worse. And then when I got out of B&H Photo, I had a doctor that kind of misdiagnosed my eyes and said that I needed this really strong, really insanely strong prescription, but it was overcorrection. So I went around the world for a week trying to adapt to these things, and I couldn't. So I had him weaking it, and then, you know, went around the world like that. And then I went to a much better doctor that told me I had a condition called keratoconus. And keratoconus, the best way to kind of describe it is to say that you have an astigmatism that changes second to second. So I'm able to concentrate through it a little bit easier because I've been meditating for years. But there's also the fact that you sometimes have really good spots for where you see. Like, you might see someone like moving their head around. And that's how you know they're in like the sweet spot for where they're able to see better. For me, with my glasses, you know, they're bigger. So that I can look around, but it also sometimes means that I might need to like clean them a little bit more often because, you know, there might be a smudge and that might be my sweet spot. So the vision has continued to deteriorate. And that's since I was 24. I turned 37 in February 15th, and less than a month from now. And there are solutions to it. One thing is a hard contact lens, but my lens would need to be so thick that it would quite literally reshape the eyelid. And that's a little bit too much. And the other thing is this thing called collagen cohesion, where they pretty much like melt collagen onto your eyes and reshape the front of the eye. But you have to get it done several times per year, from what I've understood. And I've talked about it with my doctors before. And, you know, I think really the best thing is to just keep getting new glasses, at least for the moment. I haven't really done the collagen cohesion. I don't want to do a hard contact lens, you know. What if, as a photographer, like something flies into my eye and it breaks the hard contact lens? There's a lot of concerns that I have about it, and I've thought about it for a while. But yeah, I have accepted that I will never see normally. When I've talked to people about this, they're like, can you see what that looks like normally? And I'm like, I don't really remember what that's like. Like, it's been this way like a third of my life pretty much now. So that's the story of my vision.
So you described what people look like to you, but when you're just navigating the world, when you're outside, what – How can you describe what that looks like to you?
You know, I was watching the show Daredevil a while ago, and he described it the best, kind of like an impressionist painting. And I did more research into that, and that is how I see the world. But by walking around and navigating, like, people might navigate by looking at street signs or something like that. I navigate partially that way, but also by looking at landmarks. And sometimes I'll give myself like random challenges. I'll go out into the rain. I'll take my glasses off because the rain is too hard. And I will navigate back home by looking at landmarks, seeing like, you know, this building that's been around since before the 1940s and seeing the quality of light and the way that it falls at a park. and knowing that that's where the park is than by listening to certain things like the subway. Where I am in Queens, the subway is above ground. So I can tell where the subway is, and I can tell, like, this might be Roosevelt Avenue. And then from there, I can know whether I have to go east or west. That's usually how I navigate the world. And otherwise, it's sometimes about, like, memorization, feeling things. I can tell you, it's a challenge when I have to travel and, like, navigating, like, a new hotel and understanding that, like, this is the route that I should take. But, you know, what if I took this other route? A lot of different things based on, like, feeling, based on, like, looking at a hole and trying to make out the puzzle pieces, sound, all that kind of stuff. That's what I've had to use.
Did you come to know other people that had that lived with, you know, challenges like yours, or were you like the only, oftentimes the only one in the room?
Most of the time, I'm the only one in the room, especially within our industry. Mm-hmm. In the yoga community, I have met a couple other people that do have problems with vision that are similar to mine, but none of us are exactly the same. I've met other people who are legally blind, but when we switch glasses, you know, their left eye might be worse than mine, or my right eye might be stronger. So no one's really the exact same in that situation, and in, you know, any of the situations that I've been in. Something that I do to rehone my vision is I go to archery. And in the archery community, like, most people have, like, perfect vision. There are people that are legally blind that do have issues like this. Mm-hmm. And I've encountered it in, like, the food community and the other places within the journalism world. But no one with something exactly like me. And that's partially, again, because it varies so much from person to person.
It must be a challenge just to navigate the world, much less, you know, the business world, with, you know, with limited eyesight. And I'm trying to find the right word for it while I'm talking to you about it, because it's like I don't want to phrase it incorrectly. So forgive me if I'm, like, fumbling a little bit, but
I guess you could say low vision. Low vision is usually the vernacular that's used. Yeah.
Okay. So, because to look at you, I had no awareness at all that you were, you know, that. But then you're going to be faced with situations where it is going to become a factor. And to my thinking, for example, this is not completely analogous to you, but when I tell my name, when I say my name, oftentimes I have to explain it to people, right? What it is, where it's from, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then, but I can imagine that when something comes up where you have to explain that you have low vision, that you have to get into this sort of dialogue of explaining and maybe even trying to convince somebody that that's what you're dealing with.
Every time, yeah. Every time I go into a new bar, for example, I let them know. I'm like, hey, what kind of whiskey do you have? Just letting you know, I am legally blind, though. Could I take a photo, or could you let me know about, like, what rye you have or something like that? And I think my communication skills have really helped there. You know, like you, you're an interviewer in the podcast world. I'm an interviewer in the photo world, you know, in printed blog stuff. Photographers shouldn't even be called a blog anymore. We've been around for 14 years. You know, we're a website. We're an online magazine, you know. But in addition to that, too, having deep empathy and be able to understand and talk with people, that has helped me out quite a bit. And then the longer people are around me, the more that they can understand things. And usually if they're, like, going on a photo walk with me, or, like, we're walking to a certain place together, I'll sometimes spot certain things, and they'll be like, wow, you see the world in a really different way. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, we all kind of do. So I think where it has been the biggest challenge is sometimes when I'm going to another country and the person doesn't necessarily speak English as well. Like, for example, when I go to Germany, mm-hmm. I try to tell them, you know, I'm legally blind, and I try to learn the words for those kinds of things. Where I am in Woodside, Queens, there are a lot of people that speak Spanish and they don't really speak any English. So trying to get them to understand that I am legally blind and what that means can be a little bit difficult, especially because, you know, the vernacular isn't the same from country to country and language to language. In the Desi community, that has been fairly simple for me to do because, you know, English is such a big language in like India and Nepal and all that kind of stuff. So I haven't really had a problem there. But when it comes to like exercising and other sorts of things, it can be a little bit more difficult. I used to do Ishin Ryu, which was a type of martial arts. And the studio I went to, it was like, oh, well, you have a 1-year contract. And if you want to get out of it, you need like some sort of doctor's note. So I had to have my doctor quite literally write a note about the fact that I had keratoconus and that I am not fit for contact sports. And some of the teachers, they were, you know, giving me a little bit gruff about it. But the owner, he was like, no, I could tell from the beginning that like you had problems and like this isn't going to work. So he just let me go. He was like, yeah, no, like, I mean, it might not work for you, but if you ever do want to give this a try again, there are places in Manhattan that do specialize in kinds of things like this. And, you know, my former copy editor, he's I think he's a judo specialist. And he was like, no, it's more about feeling and like learning how to react and wire that into your head. So there's all sorts of different situations where my vision, I don't want to say that it holds me back. I do try to do things as normally as anyone can, but it is a factor. And sometimes it takes me a little bit longer for things to work. A great example of that actually in the camera testing world, Canon on the R3, there is a feature, kind of like what they used to have, the E-Lens 7 camera, where the camera will detect your eye, see where you're looking, and then move the autofocus point to exactly in that spot. Because of the shape of my eye, it cannot do it. And that's an issue, you know, with people with astigmatism, with people with keratoconus, because the astigmatism basically changes second to second and movement to movement. But if you have like perfectly fine eyes or, you know, you're not wearing glasses or something like that, it's usually okay. But, you know, you find ways around it. You use a touchscreen. You use a joystick. Autofocus is a very good thing. I'm not going to lie about that. You find ways. You really do find ways. You adapt. You persevere. And I think that's a beautiful part of humanity. I've been meditating for over 20-something years, and to think that, like, you know, our ancestors, they used to be in caves and they found a way to make fire. And with fire, they found a way to find their way in the darkness. And from there, they found ways to farm and make more permanent structures and build cities and cook, which helped them out in so many different ways. And, you know, you think about those things and it's like, you know, if humanity could have done that, I can find a way just to navigate around the world.
It's interesting then that your eyesight isn't translated into what you reproduce with the camera, right?
Well, in some of my projects it is. In some ways, some people will be like, oh, this is out of focus. I'm like, okay. But yeah, thank you for saying that. Sometimes I wonder if cameras see better than we do in terms of like sharpness and all that kind of stuff these days.
But I sometimes think that not having, I mean, for me, exactness is often informing my compositions, right? I'm looking at the intersections of really small, fine lines, points of contrast. But sometimes I have thought and had discussions with other photographers that sharpness is overrated. You know, pristineness, you know, perfection, and that, and letting go of that kind of control can sometimes result in really interesting photographs. And I wonder if you find that because of the way that you see, that that naturally comes through in the photographs that you make sometimes.
Yeah, it does. And sometimes it means that I'll add filters onto a camera, like a Pro Mist filter or Glimmer Glass or something like that. Or I'll do something like in-camera movement to create something that looks like an in-camera made painting. So I totally do those kinds of things. And then when shooting, I'm sometimes just like, oh, this is cool, but it looks just like everyone else's photos. I want something completely different. Mm-hmm. Why don't I embrace, like, you know, using a slower shutter speed, using some sort of other technique like second curtain flash or something like that. So I think that my vision and the way that I see the world motivates how I shoot. And I think that's a big difference that isn't spoken enough. And I think I'd hope that you would agree with me. Like, cameras teach us how to look, but they don't teach us how to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I've been, you know, I do a good amount of teaching, and I've just been making that observation, that at some point with every photographer, they get good enough, right? They can make a well-exposed, in-focus photograph. And the question is like, well, now what, right? You can consistently make a good photograph. And I think that the rabbit hole that people get into is trying to get, quote-unquote, better, right? But not necessarily trying to explore what they can or want to say with the camera. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the trap that a lot of people fall into, where they're continually improving their skill set, but they're not necessarily saying anything.
I agree with you. And they're also trying to feed into algorithms than trying to, you know, express themselves creatively. I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, but that's the idea, is trying to find, okay, you don't necessarily have to buy the next bit of kit. You don't necessarily have to upgrade the software. What do you want to focus on? What do you want to explore? What do you want to express about how you experience the world through your photographs? And that's where I think the differentiator between the photographers that I often end up talking to and, you know, and the majority of photographers that exist pretty much on social, Facebook and Instagram, who are just making, you know, nice photographs, but there's nothing to look, you don't look at their work and go, oh, John, you know, John shot this or Ellen shot that. You know, it's just replications of other people's styles and sensibilities. And every once in a while, you'll see somebody and you just go, whoa, what is this person doing?
Mm-hmm.
And it just comes from them leveraging who they are through the camera. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, with your limited eyesight, that informs your work as well. And also, you know, no doubt your cultural heritage, how you grew up, so on and so forth.
Yeah. I try to have it inform the way I work. And in the past year or so, I've actually been trying to embrace that a little bit more. At Fablographer, I've usually had the staff, like, we all understand that we kind of do have to hold back in our creativity, one, in order to review as much gear as comes out, mm-hmm. but also to kind of be able to speak to the more common photographer. And I hire, like, really great people. But, you know, in the past quarter of a year, I was just like, man, all this stuff is so monotonous. It's all more or less the same. I think we're going to review less of it, and we're going to be embracing our own creativity a little bit more. We should be doing projects with these things. And if there is something that is not innovative in any way, shape, or form, probably doesn't deserve a review. It really doesn't, especially with a publication like ours, where, you know, we're taught actively in schools. And we also try to do things where we help photographers see, but not necessarily look and mm-hmm. learn more and get inspired and figure out ways that they can differentiate themselves from an AI algorithm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been trying to do a lot of those things right now. And it means slowing down. And I kind of like that because, you know, Mr. Rogers had this great quote about saying that people, the best people in his life, give him the gift of silence because there's so much noise around and it's constantly bombarding your mind. And Rogers died maybe, I don't know, maybe like 10 years ago.
Yes.
And that quote still resonates with me because I'm like, oh, there's so much noise. Like my phone might have a ton of notifications and I might silence it, but there's still notifications coming in. I had to silence the photographer uses Gmail for work. I had to silence the Gmail app on my phone just because there's so much stuff coming in. And I had to start marking people as like spam and saying like, no, I'm going to mute these notifications just so I could concentrate more. There's so much noise in this world. And I really love reading because of that. I love meditating without any sort of notifications coming in. And I love finding ways to turn off my brain and meditating at the fact that like I can silence those parts. And that kind of, that gives me rest and it gives me clarity and it helps me be creative a little bit more. And I really think that the generation of creative photographers that are coming out right now cannot think that way.
Yeah. They, as we speak, there's been in the past month a bunch of YouTubers that are either retiring, which is kind of a strange thing to say, or sort of pulling back. And part of the discussion is for a long time they've become the slaves to this ever changing algorithm, right? That in order to pursue numbers and audience and things like that, they have to been this constant grind of producing content and eventually have burned out for all intents and purposes. And that's something that I've been aware of, not only in terms of what gets fed to me as far as the algorithm, but also in terms of what happens with the show. I mean, I've consistently been doing this show for 16 years. And because of the nature of the podcast apps, if you haven't listened to an episode or two, it stops updating on the application someone's using. And they'll come to me, are you still doing it? I haven't seen anything. And it's just like, it's not because I'm not doing it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I've toyed with the idea of putting, you know, video content out up there, but I've been resistant to it because like so many of people that I know who do have YouTube presences, so much of their content is shaped by the algorithm. Mm-hmm. They may start off with one particular intent, but eventually, since they're relying on that output for their income, whatever sort of artistic or creative intention they may have begun with, it has to be put aside in order to keep hitting that number mark. And I know that's something that you've experienced. So it's, and you know, you did a recent post about the changes that you want to create to the website, and it seems that a lot of it was kind of informed by that very thing.
Yeah, partially that, but also, I mean, I took a really hard turn during the pandemic. We used to publish 7 times a day, man.
Oh, wow.
7 times a day, 4 times each day on the weekend. And then I was like, we don't have to do this. I was looking where the traffic was coming from. I'm like, we can do 4 times a day. And then I switched it to 4 times a day on the weekdays and twice on the weekends each day. And this year, like, I've been affected by all those things as well, too. I've had to pull back on staff and all that kind of stuff. So right now, I'm only publishing 4 times a day on the weekdays. And even that's a lot. But I'm doing different things. I'm not trying to, for Blogger, you know, because we're an accredited publication, because we've been around for so long, most of our traffic comes from SEO, search engine optimization. Google's always been the great things about that. But man, Google algorithms for search have changed dramatically over the years. And even last year, there were so many changes. And it really annoys me that there's one company in the world that dictates what journalists do when it comes to reviews. And I was like, no, I'm slapping that in the face. I don't want to do that anymore. So I've been doing other things that work for Foblogger, like Google Discover, for example, which, you know, when you've been around for a longer period of time, you get a little bit more leeway when it comes to that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But also creating the articles that I want to create. And I'm being very careful to not say the word content, because I don't want to be lumped in with content creators, and you shouldn't be either. You know, you're a podcaster, you're mm-hmm. a photographer, you're a journalist in some ways, you know. I am a journalist. I am a publisher. I am a photographer. I'm not a content creator. Don't belittle what I do by calling it content. You know, Foblogger with our articles, a lot of it is perennial. It stands for a really long period of time. Some of it is fleeting, but content is fleeting, and art is not fleeting. Art is something that stands a long time. It can go into a museum. It can go into a gallery. I won't see, like, you know, some video being done for content creation going into any of those places. I don't see it having long-term viability or standing. So, yeah, that kind of stuff has been informing a lot of what I create and what I edit and what the site puts out. I was looking at our editorial calendar today, and, you know, you and I were recording on January 20th. Foblogger is scheduled March 6th. We have to be ahead at any one time. And, you know, Monday I'll write more, and Wednesday I'll write more, and Friday I'll write more, and Tuesday and Thursday I spend days answering emails, doing calls like this, advertising stuff, coding, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot that needs to be done, and I need that mental silence that I was talking about earlier on to help me recharge and to refocus and to endure, you know? And I'm very positive you can understand that.
Oh, yeah. Since you're doing a lot of writing, looking at a screen, how does your limited eyesight, what sort of accommodations do you need in order to be able to, you know, look at text and layout and those things?
So something I tell everyone that I discovered when I took over all advertising relations is that I cannot do spreadsheets for the life of me, because like I'll see a line or I'll see a row, and there'll be like, this is the row right here, and there'll be like eight rows around it, kind of like a kaleidoscope.
Okay.
And if I'm looking at it from my left eye or my right eye, it looks different, and I sometimes have to enlarge the screen. Oh, my camera just went out. I'm gonna redo that. I sometimes have to enlarge the screen, and I have to do a whole bunch of other things. I am on a 27-inch iMac, and my text is a little bit larger than what people normally see. My brightness is a little bit larger. I usually do everything in dark mode, and I have a couple of accommodations in terms of like colors and being able to see things. I don't like the idea of pure white on black. I like the idea of light gray on dark gray a little bit more. It's more kind on my eyes. That's what I like to say.
I'm frequently asked for tips for how to become a better photographer. My first suggestion is always to make as many photographs as you can. Don't just wait for the weekend or vacation to practice. The second is to look at great work. Find a photographer whose work moves and inspires you, and immerse yourself in their photography. Though a phone or a computer is a convenient way to look at work, a book provides a special experience. A book invites you to settle in, avoid distractions, and enjoy a full experience with a photographer. I've learned what makes a good photograph by looking at the work of Gordon Parks, Mary Ellen Mark, Sam Abel, and countless others in just this way. That's why books remain so special to me. And you can experience that same thing each month with your membership to the Charcoal Book Club. With your membership, you receive a quality monograph each month. The book reflects a diversity of genres, photographers, and styles you'll enjoy, even if you're not a practicer of that genre of photography. And if you don't like that month's release, you can choose an alternative book of equal value in their catalog. They offer free shipping to the US, Canada, and UK. It's subsidized elsewhere. Sign up today and use the promo code BeCandidFrame at checkout to enjoy 10% off your first membership payment. Because of all the writing that I do, I have, I guess, relatively normal eyesight. But it's when it comes to text, man, it's quite the challenge. Like one of the things when I write something, I usually do the text to speech thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't, so that I can catch things that otherwise I don't wouldn't catch because I kind of gloss over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that helps a lot. And so I can imagine with the amount of text that you have to go through that there are tools like that you may have to use in order to be able to effectively do the work that you do.
Yes, there are. One of them is Grammarly. Grammarly is helps me out with copy editing a little bit. Otherwise, when it comes to like photo editing, I used to zoom in at 100% to make sure something was in focus, and I still kind of do, but otherwise, like, I don't really care. I'm just like, no, how does the composition look? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I may make my crops accordingly. Like, maybe this doesn't work well in a landscape format. Maybe it'll work better cropped to a portrait format, or maybe it'll look better as a square or something like that. Other things I use are very specific lighting. Strategically, like on my desk, I have a mechanical keyboard and the buttons illuminate, but I also have like a desk lamp that has a light that fills and spreads just enough so that I can see other things on my desk. And then my office has western facing lights and southern facing lights. So sometimes I might move the curtains accordingly to block mm-hmm. out some of the light coming onto my screen that causes reflections, and then opening another curtain up to be able to let more natural light in. So, you know, I just feel better. And then I'm trying to think about what other sort of accommodations I do. Like when I'm looking at a camera screen, the diopter does matter for sure. I'll usually have to crank it all the way one way or another. The camera screens itself, I'm usually okay with those, especially like the higher megapixel ones. Like now they're at like 2.3 dot resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nice. Other than that, no, that's mostly about it. Sometimes I switch between reading on my computer to reading on my tablet and reading on my iPhone just because, you know, I can take my tablet or my iPhone in a different room and it gives me a little bit more ease. And then sometimes I need to do certain things on my desktop. I used to be one of those people that like on Tuesday and Thursday, I'll take a laptop and I'll go to a cafe and I'll read there, or I'll answer emails there. And then I realized, you know, there were certain things I couldn't totally do on like a 13-inch or 14-inch screen. So I have to do it back on my desktop. So those are the things that keep me kind of tied to a desktop. And then also like moving around to different locations. A lot of it has to do with light. A lot of it has to do with being able to enhance the text large enough, colors, all that kind of stuff. So there is quite a bit to keep in mind when I am working, but you know, despite that, I still get a lot done.
You've mentioned in one of the articles that you wrote, excuse me,
sure.
About talking to camera manufacturers about incorporating features that could benefit people with limited eyesight. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so some of them involve increasing the size of the text so that you can read it easier. Quicker navigation of the menus. Different color setups to make it easier for people to be able to differentiate in the menu, like one section via another. A lot more pictures. Cameras possibly talking to you a little bit more in terms of like the menu settings. Better EVFs, brighter EVFs, more contrasty EVFs. Something that I've really seen is the addition of sapphire glass makes it very easy to eliminate reflections.
This is in the viewfinder?
This is in the viewfinder and also in the LCD screen. Minimizing reflections there can really help because, you know, when there are reflections on your camera screen and then you're wearing glasses, sometimes there are reflections that pop up on your glasses, even if you have anti-reflective coatings on it. You know, the coatings are more on the front than they are on the back. So if there's a light behind you, it's going to reflect into your glasses and it's going to mess with your eyesight completely. Those are mostly the things. And then in addition to that too, like finding buttons in the dark, like illuminated buttons are great. Lumix, you know, for years I've called them Panasonic, but these days they want to go by Lumix, and I'll respect that. You know, I like to call it the pronouns. Yeah. Lumix wants to go by, Lumix has this thing on their ISO button where there are perforations. It's very easy to be able to find that button in the dark. And from there, you can know by muscle memory that like, oh, you go to the right and that's the exposure compensation button. And you go to the left and that's the white balance button. So certain perforations on buttons will help a whole lot. Sometimes the illuminated buttons, that's a big one that Nikon does. I wish Fujifilm did that. I wish Canon did that. Even the retro dials can help quite a bit, like what Fujifilm has. Like with the X-Pro3, you know, I can be at 1/125th, and then I know that, like, with three clicks, I can be at, like, 1,000th or, like, 1/500th or something like that. And you can't always get that from the more SLR-style cameras because when you're just, like, scrolling through and you hear the clicks or you feel the clicks, they don't necessarily always register the same way that a hard stop on a dial does. You can get that with the aperture rings on the lenses for sure. But otherwise, no, not necessarily so the case.
Yeah. And I can imagine that with someone with limited eyesight who is practicing photography, that the old film cameras were far easier to learn and master because for the most part, all the controls are always in the same way, shutter speed, aperture, you know, ISO focus. And today with all these cameras now, they're all configured differently. The layout's different. Buttons and controls have multi-functions. And for you who's evaluating these cameras in order to write a review and you only have like a limited window with which to initially work with them, that it must be, you know, really a challenge, if not a pain in the ass sometimes, to have to try to, you know, figure out this camera well enough that you can, you know, write about it.
Yeah, 100%. But I am able to learn them pretty quickly. You really spend like an hour with each camera trying to like set up my custom settings and all that kind of stuff. It's the same thing with any reviewer that's also worked for me. They need to be able to sit there and they need to cycle through all these different things. For me, it's one of the big things is I take the exposure preview mode off just because it kind of messes with my vision a little bit too much. Mm. I like it to be more constant. And I know photographers, like if I'm shooting with them, they'll like to put the exposure preview on. And I'm just like, no, just learn Sunny 16 or like read the light meter or something like that. And they won't necessarily do that. They'll want to look at like what the camera actually renders. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But like, it's better for my eyes if I'm seeing a constant picture and I can read all these other things like the light meter, or I can read like this is like F11 at ISO 400 and 1/1000th of a second or something like that. That kind of stuff really does help me. Sunny 16 helped me a lot, man. Like being able to sit there, look at the quality of the light in the scene, spot shadows, being able to know that like, oh, ISO 100, F16, 1/100th of a second, easy, no problems. And when I go into the subway being like, oh, ISO 3200, F2, 1/500th or 1/1000th of a second, easy. Being able to spot those light differences and work with those and just shoot, so much easier than just like needing to dial it in all the time. Sometimes aperture priority is nice, and you know, I've even gotten into using program auto mode these days. I'm just like, you know, I know how to do all this stuff. Why don't I just see what the camera can do?
Does, you know, when you look at an image through this on a computer screen, you're dealing with this backlit as opposed to a print where it's like reflected. Do you find that you favor one over the other just because of the nature of the way you see things?
I personally like looking at prints more. But something that also annoys me is when I go to a museum and there are reflections on the prints, because like if it's a luster paper or if it's like a more glossy paper, then I'll see reflections of like, you know, the prints behind me or the light coming in from the windows or the ceiling lights. And I've seen that a lot at like ICP here in New York. They have exhibits where they cut down on that and it's really nice. But then when it's really bad, it's really bad. But at Fotografiska here in New York, they're very specific with their lighting, and that makes the image pop out and stand out to me a lot more. So I do like that. When looking at screens, I don't really like glossy screens as much. Shout out to you, Apple. Hopefully you're hearing this. I do like matte screens a lot more, although I do work on a glossy screen. Yeah, that's mostly about it when it comes to that kind of stuff. I do like consistency, though. Like, that's the nice thing about Apple screens. Like, you go from your iPhone to your iMac, and the screens will be very consistent versus, like, going to a PC where there's no consistency, and trying to get the consistency to sync up is, you know, a nightmare, especially when you're dealing with clients.
You know, with the work that you've done in the photo industry, you've likely have, you know, connected and talked with other people who deal with a variety of different vision issues, and that's probably opened up a community to you, I would think. Has it?
A little bit, yeah. And some of those people have stayed in the industry. Some of them have had things pop up with them in life. One of the photographers that founded Street Photography International is visually impaired like me, and he hasn't shot in a couple of years because I believe his wife is in a coma right now. Yeah. And that will obviously affect, you know, a whole bunch of different things in life. And then I've talked to other photographers who have visual impairment, and we have been able to relate to one another. But Iberian X, we're a rarity, man. I mean, we're around. We try to integrate and create images and express ourselves in different ways, but we're not always speaking the same language as every other photographer, and we're not always creating in the same way, and we don't always have the same experience. So yes, we're around. There isn't really a big community of us, though. And I think that some of the big differences are we shoot different things. You know, there are editorial photographers. There are colorblind photographers that shoot food. There are people with Kira Taconis like me that shoot landscapes. And those different genres create differences in a whole bunch of us. You know, there can be a photographer with Kira Taconis like me that mostly shoots landscapes or does astrophotography. And I do some of those things, but these days I'm mostly doing photojournalistic work, some portrait stuff, and some conceptual portraiture. So because I speak that different art language, it doesn't necessarily translate to a landscape photographer. Mm-hmm. That's obviously we both have that nature thing in common, but we don't have the nurture thing in common. So it creates differences.
I spoke to Joe Grimes some years ago, and who's colorblind. And he was really fascinating to discover that this look he had become identified with was a direct result of his colorblindness. That the sort of desaturated look was his sort of compensation for not being able to evaluate color in the way that most people do. So he was sort of correcting for that by desaturating slightly and doing some other things. And it became his signature. Right. That a bunch of other people ended up sort of emulating simply because they saw him doing it. And it's fascinating to see what some people would identify as a weakness. Right. It could end up becoming a strength simply by not allowing that to stop you from doing it, but basically finding a way of working with it, which is, you know, something that it seems you're doing.
Yeah. Years ago, I spoke with a color rep that told me that Terry Richardson is colorblind. Hmm. And, you know, Terry Richardson has influenced a whole lot of photographers. Every year, you know, the direct fill flash look comes back gets applied to fashion, or it gets applied to food photography, or it gets applied to events or something like that. Visually impaired people, it allows us to look at the world in a different way, but it also allows us to see in a different way. And it helps us hopefully channel the way that we see into the images that we create.
I was having a conversation this week with another photographer at work. And the crux of the conversation was about how working with limitation can be such an advantage. There was a photographer that you wrote about on, I think it was on your site, who's a fashion photographer who's working with a Nikon 3030 or something like that. He's working with a camera that he got like when he first started shooting. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name.
I interview a ton of photographers, but you can go on.
But anyway, he's using a camera, 60 megapixels, you know, it's mid-range, and he's producing his work. I mean, he's producing professional work as a result of this. And I looked at that, and in the discussion, it's like people often focus on the things they don't have and think that, oh, if I only had this or that, then I would be able to do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And it was like, no, it's the complete reverse. It's like, you don't have to have very much in order to go out and start making it. You could have a 15-year-old digital camera. You could have a smartphone. You could only have one lens and make an amazing, you know, body of work. It's simply, you know, going back to the thing that started this conversation is like, well, what do you want to say? You know, and don't wait for the accumulation of some piece of equipment or permission from somebody else to go out and do it and make it happen.
Yeah. I think that's a problem with our society, though. Like, we don't understand the idea of perseverance, or it's not taught to us. Some of us have it. Some of us don't. I wish more people took it into their hands, because then, you know, actually, no, I take that statement back. A problem is, too, we don't necessarily always have the mentorship in place, especially when it comes to the arts. That kind of funding has been cut so much from schools. Oh, yeah. But if we had that, I think people could find a way to creatively find solutions to the problems that they have, especially when it comes to making photos.
Finding your tribe. I mean, this as connected as we are today, I think we're more isolated than we have ever been. Mm-hmm. And especially for people who are creative, trying to find the community that will end up nurturing and emboldening us to take risk is really difficult. I find it as connected as I am, right, with as many people as I know, even for me, it's a struggle to maintain connections with people who I feel inspire and nurture me in that way.
And that can come because, you know, we're also changing. But do you find that the quality of those connections also changes?
Quality. How are you defining that?
Deep connections versus the more fleeting ones, I would say.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there are a handful of people who I can talk to and enjoy speaking with. Arthur Myerson is one of those photographers, just legendary commercial editorial photographer. And every time I get on the phone with him, it's just complete joy for me to sit down with him and talk. And there are other people like that. And we don't necessarily talk about photography, right? Mm-hmm. We just enjoy the opportunity to be connected with each other, right? And we'll talk a little shop, but for the most part, it's about, you know, enjoying each other's presence and humanity and just love of life. And sometimes that's all I need. But it's nice to have people kind of understand the path that we're walking.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Right? And that's really, really helpful because there are moments where there's struggle involved or where there's doubt. And being able to broach it without having to sort of explain, lead up to the conversation by having to explain yourself.
Yeah.
Is it nice?
No. Yeah. And that's why I was asking that question. Like you're saying we are connected, but in so many ways we are disconnected. I feel like also, you know, people can come and go in this industry all the time for one reason or another. Some people are burned out. Some people just get sick of it or they change and they do something else. And that's why I also feel that like deep connections are really missing these days. And I think that became even more pronounced after the pandemic. We forgot how to sometimes actually be social with one another and deeper conversations besides just something that's surface level and symbiotic as well too.
As far as photographers are concerned, I feel like the more we're able to get back to creating stuff that's intimate and personal is a wonderful way of broaching that. That when I take a look at work that moves me, I want to be connected. And I am connected in that moment when I see that photograph. And it connects me to another human being, whether or not I have a chance to talk to them or not. Right? And that's what I'm hungry for. Because whenever I look through Instagram, you know, it's constant swiping and what I want is that. I want that feeling. I don't want just, oh, that's a good picture. It's like, oh, it reaches through the screen and hits me in the heart. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a sense of wonder at going, wow, look at how this person saw and experienced the world in that moment. And it sings to me. And that's what I like about these conversations, the very same thing.
Yeah. You know, I also feel like I feel like prints do that better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they develop a lasting connection. I mean, my office has a ton of prints. A print from one of my very good friends is actually right behind my computer. I have prints on my first floor. And I think that's part of the connection that we are missing so much in photography. People just think about it as content creation and making stuff for like social media. And that goes hand in hand with our lack of arts education, right? Mm-hmm. We don't talk about photo books enough. We don't talk about zines enough. We don't talk about prints enough. We don't talk about looking at images in a museum enough. One of my big missions this year is actually trying to report more on the images that you see in galleries and image and in museum, and trying to help people understand the idea that that stuff has directly influenced what you see today. I wrote an article the other day about how Henri Cartier-Bresson and Robert Capa influenced Bruce Gilden. And Bruce Gilden has influenced so many photographers that we have interviewed. I literally can go back into our back end, type in Bruce Gilden, and WordPress is so good that it helps me find all the photographers who have mentioned Bruce Gilden as an influence. And, you know, when people go see Robert Capa's images or Henri Cartier-Bresson's images, they're like, man, I could have done this. Okay, but for the time, it was groundbreaking. And this image is the paramount thing that has influenced photographers for the years preceding. And that is the connection that we don't necessarily make because it's not put forward. But I feel a print can start that conversation much better than a reel.
Yeah, and Bruce Gilden is, I can't say that he's a big influence on me, but I have such a great and deep affection and appreciation for his work and how he approaches it. Because, and he's said it about his work, especially the work that he did of addicts and prostitutes. He's like, those are the people that he knew growing up, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the people that he was surrounded by as he was coming up with his kid, and his own family was in the midst of alcoholism and addiction and dysfunction. And that there's a love and an affection for those people, despite the fact that they are in the darkest of their circumstances. And he hasn't said this exactly, but basically the idea is that they deserve to be seen too. And I think it's incredibly powerful, and why, for me, his work is so important and so impactful. And it gets back to that idea of why take a picture. I think that is something we all have to sort of figure out, because if you're going to do this over decades, you have to make it sustainable. Mm-hmm. You know that. That's a question we eventually have to answer for ourselves, you know. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just endlessly, you know, catering to the algorithm and to the manufacturers and chasing your own tail, which would be unfortunate, considering the gift that you have by just being able to buy a camera and make pictures.
Yeah, and I think, you know, keeping sight of that original vision that you have is very important. I heard a quote, I'm forgetting where it was, but there's this famous quote that a fanatic is someone that doubles down on their efforts and loses sight of their original vision and their original goal. And I feel a lot of people double down on their efforts to beat an algorithm and completely lose sight of their original goal as being a creative person. And that applies not only to photographers, but like, you know, videographers, painters, sketch artists, all that kind of stuff. And that's something that I feel we need to keep in mind, especially when it comes to the type of work that you were talking about just now with Gilden. There are people that try to do it just to be exploitive and to get some clicks. And I don't think that that's the right reason. I think it's I come from a world where photojournalism was actually taught in school, graduated in 2009. And that stuff is incredibly important. Telling your story and the framing can mean so much. And people don't necessarily think about those kinds of things. They're incredibly important. And, you know, if you're doing these things just to try to get famous, and you're not trying to keep in mind the fact that all these other people are people and you need to care about them in some way, then people should get out of this business, man. Like, you shouldn't always make it just about yourself. Like, this is a people industry. Like, it's a small industry. People will talk. People will network. Yeah.
Well, my last question that I ask each guest is I ask them to recommend another photographer for our listeners to discover and explore. And it can be anyone, someone you've long admired or someone you've recently discovered. So who would that one photographer be and why?
Oh, man. One photographer. That's incredibly difficult. If I really had to name anyone right now, I would say photographer Sydney Inman. I found her on Flickr. Flickr is one of the places that I go to find inspiration for the photographers that we do interviews for on Photographer. I also go to Tumblr. I go to Behance. I go to Reddit, Visco, a couple other places. Sydney Inman is a surrealist portraiture photographer that mostly does everything in camera. And her work is incredible. I'm shocked that she's not more famous for a lot of the work that she does. But it's very telling. There's a lot of emotion in it. And she's the photographer I think I'd probably recommend. I say that while looking at a print by Brooke DiDonato right in front of me and thinking about a whole bunch of other photographers that, you know, I've been wanting to work with and interview and all that kind of stuff. But she's the one that probably has had the most inspiration on me personally these days.
Well, thank you for that. I look forward to discovering your work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Chris, thank you so much for appearing on the show, man. It was a lovely opportunity to reconnect.
Yeah, absolutely, man. This is always like therapy.
And we can always do with your financial support. Now, I know that there are a lot of requests for your money, but you make all this possible by supporting us financially. We don't spend time talking about gear and providing reviews on the latest gadgets. That means a smaller audience, and I'm fine with that. But if you're listening, it's because you want something different, and you feel you get something different here, and you can't find it anywhere else. If so, we would love for you to become a Candid Frame Patreon supporter today. You can contribute $5, $10, $20 or more monthly by visiting patreon.com/thecandidframe. Again, it's patreon.com/thecandidframe. And if you only want to make a one-time donation, you can do that now by going to buymeacoffee.com/thecandidframe. Thanks to Chris for joining us. You can learn more about Chris and his work by visiting thephablographer.com. If you're a fan of our work, you can write reviews on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts and share a favorite episode on social networks, be it X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Remember to use the hashtag #TheCandidFrame. You can also support us financially via Patreon. And if you want to make a one-time donation to the show, you can do so by visiting buymeacoffee.com/TheCandidFrame. Thanks to John Agather for their recent contribution. We've relaunched our newsletter using Substack. By subscribing, you receive weekly essays that I'm having great fun writing, as well as updates on everything related to TCF. Substack has a wonderful photographic community, and I hope you'll join us by signing up today. And if you can't find every episode of the show, on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts, download the Candid Frame app for Apple iOS and Android. And because of your generosity, it's free to download and use. No additional purchases are required. The Candid Frame's audio engineer is Martin Taylor, who you can find at theothermartintaylor.com. The show's senior producer is Cynthia Parker. And this is Ibarian X, and this is The Candid Frame.